is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
To Germany, Berlin, of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Judy Dempsey helps me to understand the European point of view, especially from the point of view of Germany, the powerhouse financial wing of the European Union, and yet at the same time now caught up, as all of Europe is, in the Ukraine conflict. We look now forward and see the third year of war looming. What is to be done? Judy, welcome back, and thank you very much. And the summertime did not advance the story profoundly. It did, however, introduce some new concepts I learned from you and your colleagues about the thinking in Europe as we end the second year of war and begin the third. One is the term post-Atlanticism. This is a term you used in an interview you did at Barcelona, and it struck my ear as appropriate for where we are now, because while the European Union and NATO remain committed, at least officially, at all their summits, there is some question about where we're going. You mentioned in a recent essay for the Carnegie, anybody can access this, Judy's the editor-in-chief of Strategic Europe for Carnegie, you recommend we pay attention to this mood that's taking hold in all of Europe as to what the future is. As long as it takes was what President Biden mentioned early in the conflict. What does that mean to Europe now, Judy? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. It's very nice to be back on the show. Thank you for having me. Well, as long as it takes, this is a kind of mantra, and it's never been really defined. Does it mean absolute victory for Ukraine? Does it mean a stalemate, which is happening? Does it mean an attempt to use this time to have negotiations? But there's definitely a sense that if the war drags on, it will be debilitating for the stability of Europe and for the economies, and indeed for the whole future of Eastern Europe as well. And above all, it will put enormous strains on Atlanticism and on the West, because they are now up against China and Russia, and you never know what role North Korea is going to play in all of this.
Post-Atlanticism, is that a thing? Has that happened, or is that op-ed thinking out loud? Is there a place where post-Atlanticism is being developed?
It's a term I used a couple of years ago before the second war in Ukraine began, because I believed that the kind of Atlantic structures that were developed after the Second World War need to be revamped, modernized, and move away from Atlanticism per se to a wider definition of the West that brings in not only all the NATO countries, but Japan, Australia, New Zealand, I suppose like-minded countries, because we have to really come to grips with the fact that the old status quo is over and there's no going back to it. And we have to think strategically now on how we're going to make the West preeminent again. And it's certainly not on the cards at the moment.
We come to a headline in the Financial Times this morning. It's echoed around the world. North Korea's Kim plans to visit Putin and Russia to discuss arms sales, according to U.S. sources. Subhead, Russia proposes joint naval drills with North Korea and China. One version of this is the escalatory language of a conflict that has not been resolved. Another is that Europe is now caught up in what appears to be a global conflict. Is that something that the European leadership is debating now, Judy? Not just Ukraine, but the fact that the unsolved conflict is spreading easily to East Asia.
Among some of the elites, yes, there is this awareness. But in some ways, the European Union is in a bubble, not a comfort zone, but in a bubble. It doesn't have the diplomacy. It doesn't have the hard power. It doesn't have the security capabilities. It doesn't have the defense outlook to actually play a major role in an extraordinarily fast-changing global setup. It's very easy to use this word global player, global challenges. But as we speak, the war in Ukraine is upturning so much, and it's pitting old powers against new powers and constellations. And really, the Europeans, as Europeans, are simply not ready for it.
Let's look at the Eastern Project. I believe that's what it's called, the Eastern Initiative of the EU. These are states that are not in the EU, but exceedingly vulnerable to the immediate violence in Ukraine. I'm thinking of Moldova. I'm certainly thinking of Georgia. And the front line is Romania, which is a member, which candidate member of the EU, or I believe.
Romania is in the EU and NATO.
That's right, but it's not the euro. I always confuse.
Oh, it's in the eurozone. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes. Okay. Yes.
No, I always confuse eurozone with EU. It gets back and forth. I have to keep separate lists. The frontier right now is exceedingly vulnerable to decisions made about Ukraine. Is that part of the debate in Europe, that if and when Russia overwhelms Ukraine's ability to defend itself, the whole of the Eastern Project, I believe that's what it's called, and all of the frontier becomes at risk permanently. Is that a debate?
It is. It's completely out there. And those who are making this a major foreign policy and security focus is Poland and Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, the Czech Republic. I mean, they are the front lines of Eastern Europe. And Eastern Europe, as we know today, is Ukraine, it's Belarus, it's Moldova, it's Georgia. And if it's not even a question of a stalemate, if this war drags on, or if there's not any kind of outcome of a victory that would give Ukraine its territorial integrity or independence, it's very hard to see stability continuing in Moldova and in Belarus. It's Belarus under the dictator Alexander Lukashenko. And it's going to make the NATO members of the Baltic states and Poland extremely nervous. And they will certainly ratchet up their defense capabilities to defend themselves, because they really are terribly afraid of what Russia might do and could do.
Now we come to the part of your most recent essay that I found the most threatening. The Vilnius summit, late July. NATO had an opportunity right in front of them to embrace Ukraine, to bring it into NATO. Why hesitate? What was the thinking? Can we imagine what they were seeing ahead?
There are several countries inside NATO, and this includes the United States and Germany in particular, maybe France as well, but not explicitly, that they believed that if Ukraine was offered NATO membership at the Vilnius summit this past in the summer, then it would provoke Russia, and this could lead to a direct confrontation between Russia and NATO. Well, we're back to the big question: how do you defend then Ukraine, and how do you actually say to countries that want to join NATO, I'm sorry, you're not ready, or we're not ready, you should be honest about it, but Ukraine desperately needs a promise and a soon membership of NATO, whether it's going to happen next year in Washington at the big anniversary summit on the founding of NATO, one doesn't know, but time is really running out. Putting NATO on the long term for Ukraine is detrimental to Ukraine and its morale. But also, what sort of signal does it send to Russia that NATO won't make that leap and bring in Ukraine?
Is it accurate to say that the European Union, that NATO countries in Europe believe in the escalatory language, that if we do this, then world war? Or is that a talking point that finds a home? I can't tell from this distance.
It's very hard to tell, but it's certainly out there. But the thing is, the war has been going on for such a long time now, 2.5 years. And let's not even talk about the destruction and the loss of life and the appalling damage that's done to Ukraine, our neighbor. But whenever the whole issue of NATO comes up, giving NATO membership to Ukraine in the short term, the response is, oh, well, we don't want a third world war with Russia. And so out there is the feeling, oh, well, Russia could strike back, so maybe we should keep the stalemate as it is. But this stalemate is terribly dangerous because it is so destabilizing and it is so costly in terms of lives and the whole structure, the security structures of Europe and indeed of NATO. There is so much at stake now as this war continues.
I'm trying to imagine what Europe sees as the future. As long as it takes, it's not the future. That's an indefinite presence. There will be a day when Ukraine is not the only story that dominates Europe. How does Europe see itself going forward? Knitting up relationships with Russia or maintaining a permanent frontier bastion against Russia? Is anybody talking about that when you come together?
No, there is mutterings. Well, you know, one day we will have to deal with Russia, but the time isn't right yet, especially of how Prigozhin was killed, who ran the Wagner Group. But this Russian attack on Ukraine has showed a couple of things about Europe: that it cannot do foreign policy in a global sense, or even a regional sense. Its entire focus is now on Ukraine. We have the anniversary of the Iranian demonstrations led by brave women. It's occurring this week. And the European Union are completely out of the picture. They're completely out of the picture about the military coup in Niger and what's happened in Gabon, despite all the rhetoric of having a brand new start for Africa and the EU. And what I'm saying is that without thinking strategically or hard power, Europe is just going to be focused on one issue at the time, and this is Ukraine, to the detriment indeed of its influence elsewhere. But clearly its influence hasn't gone very far over the past several decades.
I'm speaking with Judy Dempsey, the editor-in-chief of Strategic Europe, a part of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She's in Berlin, and we've been speaking of the EU and NATO and the Eurozone generally. We now turn to Berlin when we come back. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.